wrestle in the mud till I had you on your back. This is A Question of Balance on 2SER 107.3 FM. Good evening. I'm Ruby Vincent. To people who have listened to A Question of Balance over the years, the name Dr. Arthur White may ring a bell. He's been with us from the beginning. Usually he'd talk about frogs. This time he's come back with a wonderful mixed bag of different environmental studies. Thanks for joining us again, Arthur.
You're most welcome.
What have you got for us?
Well, will we start with women and frogs?
Oh, look, we've just had International Women's Day. Sounds spot on.
Okay, well, not very long ago, I gave a talk at a FATS meeting about basically a history of frogging in Australia. Looked at many of the people who'd been involved in the initial discovery of frogs in Australia, and then later on the scientists who got involved in finding out more about our wonderful animals. And it occurred to me when I was doing the talk that what was conspicuously missing in the talk was really the number of women involved in frog science. So I went back again and had a think about it. And basically, it turns out that there are women who have been involved in frog science, but they're really only starting to come to the fore now. If you go back and look at Australian frog science, really we don't see the names of any women appearing anywhere until about the 1970s. And people have been working on frogs in Australia from the 1830s. So, you know, that's a big hiatus. That's 140 years without a woman being mentioned. Interestingly enough, the first woman of note working on frogs was a lady in Victoria by the name of Patsy Littlejohn. Now, Patsy is one of these unsung heroes. She was the wife of Murray Littlejohn. And Murray Littlejohn was a frog biologist, and he was very interested in acoustics, the sounds that frogs make and how frogs actually use these sounds. Murray started his work in the 1950s. The first important work that he did was to demonstrate that frogs make a species-specific call to attract females of their own species. Now, that sounds so bleeding obvious, and it's old hat to everybody. But back then, people had always suspected that's the way it was, but nobody had been able to prove it. And so what he did was he did a whole series of sound recordings of frog calls of different species, then collected gravid or receptive female frogs and played the sound calls to them to see which ones they reacted to. And in that way, he was able to demonstrate that the call that the male was making was critical in this whole process. He was able then to go on to demonstrate what was called pre-mating isolation, how frogs could actually segregate parts of their population and speciate very rapidly just by doing minor changes to their call. Murray eventually married Patsy, and Patsy became his sound engineer. And so Patsy went out on all of the field trips that Murray went on, and she did all of the sound analysis. Now, in those days, of course, everything was recorded on reel-to-reel recorders. So she had all the filters and microphones and all the bits of wire and recording apparatus and stuff in the back of their little van. And they would go around all different parts of Australia, and she'd be running around with cords and leads and things going everywhere, recording, in some cases, quite minute sounds that they would later then take back and analyse to look at call structures. One of the things that they were interested in was how frogs vary their call to produce new species in such a way that females will still recognise it. So this was, you know, really quite cutting-edge stuff. The only problem with all of this is that Patsy really didn't get her name on a lot of the publications and things that came out. But everyone who was working on frogs at the time knew of Patsy and knew the work that she was doing. So she was really what I would call the first of the unsung women heroes in the study of frogs. And she worked on frogs from the 1950s right through to the mid-1970s. So she had about 25 years of serious frog work.
I want to ask something there.
Mm-hmm.
Why didn't she get her name on the things? I assume her husband had his name on them.
Correct. A lot of it's to do with tradition in science in Australia. There has been, it's still around a little bit, but nowhere near as strong. There was a tradition that only certain people could ever put their names on publications when they came out. And there was a real hierarchy of whose names could go where. Technicians, which is what Patsy would have been considered as, certainly never got a look in those days.
I recall that wonderful book about Australian seashores. The technician did most of the work.
Oh, that was Isabel Bennett?
Yes.
Yeah,
and yep. There was a huge to-do about whether or not her name could go on the book.
Correct. We've had some horrible examples over the years of students who've done massive amounts of work are having papers published and then not getting their name on it at all. Their supervisors have put their name on it. So there's been some inequalities in the past, and certainly for people who weren't strictly in the academic mould, they were very heavily prejudiced against. Let's move on, though.
Okay, well, back to the women in frogland.
Well, when we get into the 1970s, finally we have the first of the women scientists in frog biology appearing, and her name was Margaret Davies. Now, she was an anatomist, and she worked at the University of Adelaide in Mike Tyler's laboratory. Margaret worked on frogs for nearly 30 years. She started off doing a master's at ANU, as a recent graduate, and she started working on a little group of frogs called Euprolea. Now, these are little tiny mud-coloured things. They're the sort of things that everybody would typically overlook because they don't look very interesting, and they are small and they are very hard to find. When she started her work in 1969 on this group, there were only 6 species of Euprolea described. When she finished, there were 42, because most people, as I say, just simply overlooked them. They just simply dismissed them as little bits of animated mud. Not only did she, as part of that study, realise that there are many more species in that complex than we ever realised, but she also discovered that some of these frogs have some quite unusual aspects to their biology. And she actually started a whole area of new work in science, which was to do with the behaviour of frogs, because these little tiny frogs don't have terribly many defences, and yet they're a highly successful group, and they are successful not because they're stronger and not because they're smarter or anything like that, because of the behavioural strategies that they have. And so she started off a lot of that work herself. Her real specialty, though, was in frog anatomy. So she was extremely good in looking at the internal structures of frogs and doing basic structural comparison of frogs. During her time, she described over 30 species of frogs herself, but also provided material for the discovery and description of quite a number of other frogs. Her work was so highly prized that in 2015, she was awarded AOM, for services to herpetology, which is really, really good. So she's the first woman scientist in the frog world that was actually formally recognised for her work, unlike poor old Patsy Littlejohn.
First lady, what was it?
Patsy Littlejohn.
Did Patsy ever get recognition in terms of employment or position status in a university?
No, nothing like that at all.
Ah, well, move on.
Decade. They were the times. Coming more recently, we now step into the year 2000, and a young female postgraduate appeared by the name of Sky Wassons. Now, Sky, she is a straight ecologist, but had an interest particularly in wetland-dependent fauna, in particular species that occur in the inland regions of Australia that occupy these ephemeral wetlands that may be dry for 20 years but then get flooded during the 1 in 20 year or 25 year flood and go through their entire life cycles within a 3-month period or 6-month period and then are quiescent for many years afterwards. And of course frogs fit neatly into that category, you know, the desert frogs. So she ended up doing a lot of work in the Murray-Darley Basin, but her main study area was the Lobidji floodplains. So she was so good at looking at a lot of these animals that were respondent to changes in water flow and water availability that she ended up becoming a major government advisor, particularly on things like the release of environmental flow water from some of our inland dams and what that was likely to do to some of the downstream fauna. What she was able to show was that the timing of environmental flows was critical for some of these animals and plants, particularly in terms of, say, triggering flowering events or triggering breeding events for some of these animals. If the environmental flows occur at the wrong time, nothing may happen and you may well have wasted that event entirely. So she's been a real big mover and shaker in the frog world, particularly the management of some of our inland frog species. I counted up the other day, she has 58 frog publications to her credit, which is very good, but she's got numerous other publications on birds and also, and invertebrates from the floodplains inland. So Skye's a very good person to have appeared on the scene, adding to the story of the weird ecology of some of our frogs. One of the ladies that I came across first, being a Sydney-sider, was a woman by the name of Marion Anstis. Now, Marion was a music teacher all of her life, and I met her when she was president of the Australian Herpetological Society. The Herpetological Society is for people who are keen on reptiles and frogs. Her interest was actually in tadpoles. At the time, nobody had done any serious work on tadpoles, especially not in Australia. And she was starting to write up some interesting descriptions of the behaviour of tadpoles. But she could only do little bits and pieces here and there because obviously she was working full time. So she managed to get out a few papers. When she retired, she went full bore into the study of Australian tadpoles. Within 4 years of her retirement, she put out her first opus, which was a publication called The Tadpoles of Southeast Australia, where she had described in great detail not only the structure but also the behaviour of about 120 species of tadpoles from the most populated areas of Australia. This was a really seminal work. This was, you know, just absolutely cutting-edge stuff. When that book came out, we had quite a number of frog biologists come from other parts of the world to have a look at not just the work itself, but to see how she actually got some of that information, because a lot of it depended on her being able to collect the eggs, rear the eggs up and bring the tadpoles through all of the various stages of their development, because she was documenting all of this in great detail. And some of these frog species, by the way, have very, very unusual and very special requirements for development. So she managed to put out The Tadpoles of Southeast Australia, as I say, which was just, you know, one of these breakthrough sort of publications, which certainly, you know, drew the attention of the international community. But about 10 years later, and only about 4 years ago, she went one step further. She put out The Frogs and Tadpoles of Australia. She did every frog species in this country. Now, that's never been done anywhere in the world. What you tend to find is that if anybody does any work on tadpoles, it'll be on just one or two species. Or if you're lucky, you might get a regional publication. They might look at, say, 20 species in an area. This was the first time somebody had actually done it on a national basis. And it was a stupendous effort because this time she's looking at over 250 species of animals. Now, this work set the standards in terms of what's expected for the future descriptions of frogs. What she was able to show was that you can identify frog species in the wild quite comfortably by looking at their tadpoles. And for some frog species where the adults look relatively similar, often the tadpoles look nothing alike. And so in many cases, it's a lot easier to actually identify them on the basis of the tadpole structures. Marion Anstis just chose to work on tadpoles because she was just simply interested in them.
And where did she do that work?
She was a music teacher initially down at Wollongong, and then eventually she moved up to Hornsby, still as a music teacher. And she just did it all at home.
I was thinking, is this a kitchen that is in fact a little laboratory?
It was, although she did have some help. We were lucky in New South Wales at the time, because the associate director of the Australian Museum was a wonderful chap by the name of Harold Cogger. And Harold took Marion under his wing to some extent. Harold was one of these guys who would, if somebody had an interest and were prepared to, you know, do the hard yards, he would help them as much as he could. And Harold really became her mentor and pushed her on. Whenever she felt defeated, he was the one that would pick her up and keep her going again, because she was doing it tough. She was, you know, having to work the whole time. And it was only during after hours or weekends or during school holiday periods that she could actually do her research.
What set of years was this done?
The first tadpole paper she put out was in 1970. And she plodded along just doing little bits and pieces while she was teaching, right up until about 2003. And then she retired.
So when you were young and getting interested in frogs and snakes and reptiles and things, you didn't know anything about tadpoles?
No, I didn't. I was one of the many who knew, who could identify the adult frogs. But if you put tadpoles in a jar, I wouldn't have had a clue which species they were from.
And it didn't occur to you, you know, how come nobody's looked at this, or I wonder if they're different, or...
Well, it's funny. When Marion first started writing her tadpole papers, I can remember other people saying that sort of thing to her. Why do you do it? No one would be interested in this. You know, all tadpoles are the same, which was turned out to be just so blatantly wrong. It was just a case that people hadn't looked.
I've often told this tale about how Darryl Jones, as a student, was told that all male brush turkeys are monogamous. He was the first one to have really reported them as a student, not being at all monogamous. And, you know, being berated, young man, everybody knows the male brush turkey is monogamous. And here are you lot sort of saying, all tadpoles are the same.
We're all guilty of biases, unfortunately. And that's one of the ones that I was guilty of, for sure.
Ah, yes, but you're the one who saw the frogs sitting on ants' nests and was able to say that they actually eat ants, which we knew, young man, was not the case.
Yeah. Well, let me tell you about some of the other women who have appeared on the scene.
Oh, before you move on from that lady, did she get any academic recognition?
Yes, she did. She was awarded an honorary PhD for the publication of Frogs and Tadpoles of Australia.
The Casula Powerhouse Arts Centre is a world-class venue in southwest Sydney with a busy schedule of exhibitions, theatre, film and workshops. Join us in March for the Archibald Prize, Shakespeare's Hamlet, Italian film screenings and more. Set along 2 kilometres of riverfront, the Arts Centre features 2 theatres, 6 galleries and a fantastic restaurant with a cordon bleu chef creating an ever-evolving menu inspired by locally grown produce. There really is something for everyone, and best of all, entry is always free. Casula Powerhouse sponsors 2SER.
Yeah, now the next lady is an interesting one. Her name is Lee Berger. Lee was a student at the time when I first heard of her, working up at James Cook University. And Lee was started off as an ecologist. She wanted to look at frog behaviour. And her initial project was to look at how frogs, some of the tropical frogs of North Queensland, behaved at different altitudes, because some species actually occur from the tops of mountains to the bottoms of mountains. And in northern Australia, the bottoms of mountains usually were lush rainforesty affairs. And when you get up the top of the tall mountains, often they're cold, wind-blown, you know, heath-covered, barren tracts, and yet you get the same species up there. So she was curious to see how these frogs actually adapted. Same species, same mountain, but at such different elevations, and obviously at such different ecosystems. So she started up a number of survey sites on some of the mountains in North Queensland, and something happened. In the first year that she was doing it, she got her first year's data okay. The second year when she went out, something started to go wrong. The frog populations on some of her sites began to crash. And by the time she got to her third year of her PhD, most of her frog sites had either been totally decimated, in other words, there were no frogs there at all, or the number of frogs had been greatly reduced. Now, she had no idea what had caused the problem. She suspected it was probably a disease. She had heard of mysterious frog deaths further south in New South Wales and Queensland at the time. So she was basically facing a dilemma. Clearly, she couldn't continue on with the PhD project she was doing because she just simply didn't have enough animals to or study sites to work with. And so she changed her entire project. And her project now was devoted towards trying to find out what had actually killed these frogs. Now, we know history tells us, of course, that Lee was highly successful in doing that. She located the pathogen, and the pathogen, of course, was the frog chytrid fungus. She first isolated it in 1995. She then decided it's not enough just to isolate it. We need to find out how to do something about controlling this pathogen. Where did it come from? Why is it so virulent? What's the likely long-term effect of this pathogen in Australia? And so she then looked at various ways of trying to control the chytrid pathogen. She looked at ways of treating infected frogs. And now she's getting right into the whole genesis of the chytrid organism and its evolution. So Lee was critical in the whole frog decline saga. It's really all due to Lee's original discoveries that frog scientists around the world have been able to pick up on the spread of chytrid across the globe and how to respond to it. I couldn't think of anyone who would have a more significant contribution to the world of frogs.
I thought one of the remarkable things was that she was able to show that chytrid had been round in the world and frogs and so on a very, very long time.
The chytrid organism is not an unusual organism at all. It's a very common fungus that occurs in soil. But the version of chytrid that causes the frog deaths is something that's only been around relatively recently. We know, for instance, that it got into Australia in 1974. From the genetic work that's been going on, it appears that this chytrid variant appeared as purely and simply the result of people jet-setting around the world. Whenever people get on a plane and go from A to B, they inevitably carry some bacteria and other forms of microscopic life with them. Now, often these little microorganisms are kept separate because they're separated by big ocean barriers and all the rest of it. Having lots of people flying willy-nilly all over the continent now all of a sudden allows many of these microorganisms to come in contact with each other, and in some cases it allows them to hybridise. The chytrid organism that became a frog killer is one of these hybrids, and we know now it's a result of human movements around the globe that actually caused this to happen. Once we realise that, of course, Lee said the bleeding obvious. If it can happen once, it can happen again. And in fact, it will happen again. It may not happen with the chytrid organism. It may happen with another bacteria, with a virus, but it'll happen. Yeah, very, very seminal sort of studies coming out of this with lots of implications for not only frogs, but also how humans behave. She was a big one. She was a big mover and shaker in the world of froggydom. Coming on from Lee Berger in New South Wales, we had a lady by the name of Michelle Stockwell who was working up at the University of Newcastle. And she picked up on Lee Berger's work on chytrid and looked to see if there were ways that chytrid could be controlled in field situations. So we had eventually had techniques for picking up sick frogs and treating them in laboratories so that they would recover from chytrid. But we had no way of actually dealing with vast wetlands that may have the chytrid pathogen in it. How do you actually protect the frogs that were in those wetlands? And so Michelle actually initiated the first studies to look at in situ protection of frogs from chytrid. And you may have heard only a month ago, the University of Newcastle announced that they have found a way of protecting green and golden bell frogs from chytrid in the field using salt regime treatments in wetlands. So we're now sort of gone past the initial shock horror of chytrid. we're now starting, we're on the front foot now in the fight of beginning to recover our frog populations again, thanks mainly to these ladies.
Well, these are all inspiring.
They are, and there's one more who's even more awe-inspiring. Marion Anstis, by the way, I forgot to mention, is a Frog and Tadpole Study Group member and is on the executive. So we're always happy when FATS people get involved in these significant breakthroughs. But there's one who's come on the scene relatively recently, and her name's Jodie Rowley, Dr. Jodie Rowley. She started in FATS as a young girl. That's where she seen her first frog, where she was given her first pet frog to look after. She has subsequently gone on to become probably the major frog biologist in the Southern Hemisphere. She has done extensive field survey work in New Guinea, through various parts of Southeast Asia and northern parts of Australia. So she's a big discoverer of new frog species, but she's also involved in a lot of projects, particularly in Southeast Asia, where she's helping particularly indigenous communities to look after their wildlife and particularly the frogs, because the frogs are the best environmental indicators you can have. So Jodie, as I say, we're particularly proud of her because she came up through FATS the whole way, and now she is the one who is really starting to make her mark in the world of frogs.
Big White returned with the pop perfect Street Talk on March 30. Street Talk includes a single, How Did You Find Out? Big White launched Street Talk May 5th at Marrickville Bolo. Spunk is a proud supporter of 2SER.
You're giving us, what, five or six shining lights there.
Absolutely.
I bet there are plenty more who've are still hidden under a bushel somewhere.
There are, and we know of more that are coming. For instance, in the University of Wollongong, there are three female PhD students at the moment. All three of them are working on different aspects of the recovery of corroboree frogs. Now, corroboree frogs are one of the most threatened frogs that we have in Australia. And so they're looking at ways of not just recovering the species in the laboratory, but eventually being able to modify their habitats in such a way that they can actually be returned to where they came from. These are the ladies who are going to, you know, really start forging the new conservation efforts in Australia.
I hope there's some kind of a historian around who would like to dig back in and see what was really going on, say, 100 years ago in this whole area, because I bet, like chemistry and so on, there are a heap of females who are acting as assistants for their husbands or other people. And their work probably just got lost, not even looked at.
That's particularly true. The further you go back in time, they would not have been acknowledged in any way, shape or form.
Well, Arthur, I think that's in some ways most inspiring. In other ways, it's a little bit sad, but
I think it's very inspiring when you see the number of women that are coming into the world of frog biology. I think there's, you know, we're coming into a new revolution here. It's great.
Right. Well, thank you very much, Arthur.
Okay. You're welcome.
That's Dr. Arthur White with a rather inspiring story about the history and presence of women in frog research in Australia. On today's program, you heard from Dr. Arthur White from the New South Wales Frog and Tadpole Study Group. Stories and soundcasts are on the AQUOG website, www.aqob.com.au. We'll be back again next week at the same time. And in the meanwhile, please take care of the environment. Bye-bye.
Let's enjoy new stuff, old stuff, a real variety.
My pleasure.
And yay!
2SER 107.3.